boosting all the participants here. So those of you who were in Bonn last year can now sit back and relax. I mentioned your name. Seriously speaking, I listed the names of the participants because I want to give the credit where it really belongs to. The results I'm going to describe in this talk are, of course, by these presenters, and it goes without saying that any errors which I do in quoting their work is solely on my own responsibility. Fermi and Chansky, why did you want to organize such a meeting? I think this now already pretty famous figure explains why. So after the first 3 months of Fermi on the orbit, it was clear that the brightest extragalactic gamma ray sources are the same blazars that we are seeing in the radio exhibiting huge variability, Parsec scale, compact jets, and flat radio spectrum. So there is an intimate connection between the gamma ray sky and between the radio sky. And we also thought that the time was ripe for such a meeting because the first Fermi catalog was published just a few months before this meeting, and many groups were working on combined radio and 1FGL studies. The central questions that we had in our minds were along these lines. So this is an excerpt from the preface of the Fermi-Chansky proceedings. Our aim was basically this: are the radio and millimeter wavelength properties and the gamma ray fibers correlated just because the radiation of both extremes of the spectrum is emitted from the Raman spectrum? Or are the two emission processes more tightly knit with possibly geospatial production of both? We hope that the workshop serves to converge the views about this and other open questions, or at least helps to outline what observations are needed to settle long-standing debates. It was properly reminded that these same questions have been around since EGRET already. So Escobaltaya, for example, mentioned that what determines the gamma ray brightness, what mechanisms are responsible, and where in the source do the gamma rays originate? These were the questions of the EGRET era already. So we are asking the same questions still, and we hope that we would converge in some of these questions during the workshop. I don't know if we actually did, but that was the original aim. And as I said, the time was right because of the first Fermi catalog. The sensitivity of the Fermi, its angular resolution, its large field of view, and the sky survey mode really made a big leap in understanding the gamma ray emitting blazar population, because in 1FGL, we have an order of magnitude more gamma ray emission sources with high confidence blazar association than in the third EGRET catalog. And Benoit Lotte gave a nice overview talk all about the with first results from the 1FGL gamma ray blazar population. One of the interesting things is that there seems to be a fairly strong correlation between the gamma ray photon index and the blazar class, with FSRQs having steep spectra, and then in the BLX you have a sequence where the spectra, the gamma ray spectrum flattens as we go from the low synchrotron peak to intermediate synchrotron peak to high synchrotron peak BLX. Another thing is that the sensitivity of the Fermi allowed detailed studies of the shape of the gamma ray spectrum and showed that many flat spectrum radio quasars and low synchrotron peak BLX actually show breaks in their spectrum. So there's an overlaw, there's break in the overlaw spectrum at about few GeV, and the change in the photon index is about 1. So this most likely is not from the radiative cooling. Some of the ideas that were presented maybe it's the underlying particle energy distribution feature in it that's represented here, Klein-Nishina effects, or possibly gamma-gamma absorption, either intrinsic to the emission region, or as Bolton and Stern had just published before the conference, maybe due to helium to Lyman combination continuum, it's pair producing with the gamma rays. One other thing in which Fermi has really made a revolution is the studies of GEV variability. Since Fermi sees any part of the sky every 3 hours roughly, and it has great sensitivity, it's possible to study well-sampled gamma ray light curves. And we see nature and we see variability from in gamma rays from timescales of months to hours. There seems to be overlaw in the orospectral density with the slope between -1 and 2. And one striking thing is that here, as you see here for DC 4.4.3, even with the, even during the times of these huge gamma ray flares, the Bolton index seems to be very constant. That's somewhat surprising. Another thing that Fermi has measured is the extra gamma ray background, and its spectrum seems to be featureless overall. An interesting point that Gino Tosti mentioned in his talk is that HEN, the unresolved HEN population, seems to be responsible only for about 30% or less of this background emission. So 70% comes from somewhere else. Maybe it's unknown point source population, star-forming galaxies, so, or maybe it's truly diffuse dark matter annihilation or something. Okay, let's look at the radio and go to the connections between radio emission and gamma ray emission. One topic that was visited many times during this meeting was the correlation between radio flux and gamma ray flux. This has been studied already during the ECRED by several groups with mixed results. In Bonn, however, there were, I think, 6 or 7 different studies of different radio samples, different frequencies, having non-simultaneous and quasi-simultaneous data, and all except for one, which was based on WMAP data, found an apparent correlation between the radio flux and the gamma ray flux. And moreover, we heard some preliminary results from Monte Carlo simulations that seem to confirm that this apparent correlation is due to an intrinsic correlation between the two. Since we know that the gamma rays are directly connected to the jets, this allows us to use the radio information also in another way. We may measure many of the key properties of these jets using single-disk or VLDI monitoring data. Key properties like the Doppler factor, the viewing angle, Lorentz factor, and the magnetic field. And these parameters can be used as an input to the theoretical modeling of the gamma ray emission. And this was a point that was raised, I think, several times during the meeting, that we should do that. Also, the gamma ray quasars seem to stand out as having distinctive properties when you look at them in radio. They seem to have faster than average apparent jet speeds. They have higher than average brightness temperatures. They have larger apparent opening angles. So this all points towards them having, on average, higher than on average Doppler factors, smaller viewing angles, and high Lorentz factors. And at this point, I say that Mac Lister in his talk reminded us that this has also to do with the flux-flux correlation, since if we have unequal Doppler boost in the radio and gamma ray regimes, that tends to destroy any intrinsic linear flux-flux correlation and actually produces an upper limit instead of nice linear correlation. So when we have larger samples, this may turn out to be an interesting diagnostic. Okay, overall, flux-flux correlation doesn't necessarily tell much about the physical connection between radio and gamma rays, except that both come from the jet and they probably have a similar amount of Doppler beaming. Sasha Puska presented a paper in the conference about time dependence of this correlation. So he had measured the time dependence of the correlation between 15 gigahertz field day four flux and the gamma ray photon flux, and found that the correlation peaks at the lag of a few months, gamma ray leading the VLBA flux, and in the source plane this corresponds to about 1.2 months, and that was interpreted as a sign of a common physical origin, and the lag being due to synchrotron opacity, which means, if this is true, this means that we would expect to see shorter delays at higher frequencies, higher radiances, which means that will be done. Let's now go to the main theme of the workshop, as I see it, which was the where do they come from? So, where is the gamma ray emission region? Is it close to the black hole within the proton region? Is it somewhere further out where you have where you have seed photon from the hot dust, or is it the standing shock identified as VLBI core, or do all of these contribute? Do we have multiple emission sites in a single jet, and are there any differences between the source classes? Do we see different regions of emission, a different site of the emission at the different source classes? The advance of this question really requires multi-wavelength data, and one of the great things about Fermi and Agile is that those missions serve as rallying points for a lot of multi-wavelength efforts, and that was reflected in the one meeting. We saw really magnificent data sets, for example, 3C279 and 3C4.3, which cover the whole electromagnetic spectrum except for the far infrared and the MEV region. And this does not only include total flux density data, but it includes also VLBI polarization and so on. So what was said about the localization, and how do we use this, how people use this wealth of observational information? From the SED modeling point of view, it looks like that it is possible to model the high energy part of the SED with models where you have, for FSRQs, you have external photon fields present in the VLR, which would place then the gamma ray emission region in FSRQs within the VLR. The variability timescales, which are sometimes very short, constrain the emission region size. And these models end up typically being optically picked at radio frequencies. So we would be rather close the black hole then. Even closer to black hole points the model by Bolden and Stern, in which they interpret the break at the few GeV seen in the gamma ray spectrum to be their production on helium-2 recombination continuum lines. and that would place the gamma ray emission region at the inner edge of the DLR. However, if we see correlated variability between gamma rays and millimeter wavelength, that poses a question that tends to point you towards regions which are much further out in the jet where the millimeter wavelengths, where the emission is optically thin for the millimeter wavelengths. And there were a lot of talks about such correlations in this meeting, talks and posters. First of all, it looks like that there seems to be extended periods of gamma ray activity, and these extended periods of gamma ray activity coincide with increased millimeter core, millimeter flux in the VLTI cores shown by Svetlana Tjørstad. In the millimeter wavelength single disc light curves, it seems that there are gamma ray flares typically at the rising part of the millimeter wavelength flare, and Escobar player pointed out that these flares usually occur after the millimeter wavelength flux has already started to rise. So this would point towards a region further out in the jet. Very interesting connection comes in the degree of linear polarization and the gamma ray activity. Looks like that the millimeter wavelength in some sources, the millimeter wavelength core seems to have an increase in its linear polarization in the degree of its linear polarization during the gamma ray activity. And in the optical polarization, there are flashes in the degree of optical polarization at the time of some large gamma ray flares. Moreover, for PKS1510, Al Marshall showed this now already quite famous rotation of the head-to-head position angle during an external period of gamma ray activity, where EVPA turns more than 700 degrees, and this rotation stops at the time of the largest gamma ray flare. And it also coincides with the time of the detection of a new knot in the VLTI chip. So this was explained, a possible explanation for this was given by a model in which there is an emission region following the spiral path to toroidal magnetic field between in the acceleration and the collimation zone between the black hole and the first standing shock in the jet, and then it finally collides with the standing shock, at which time this rotation stops and we see a large gamma ray flare. And another source which showed an interesting connection between the millimeter wavelength emission and gamma rays was 3C345, where Frank Sinsel showed a correlation between not in the flares of the gamma rays, but in the gamma ray emission trend and the jet features close to the core, but not the actual millimeter wavelength core. Okay, so our goal was to try to converge the views of the gamma ray emission side in this meeting. Did we? No. Well, we didn't. As Marcus put it in his summary of the one of the working groups, Fermi actually might divorce Jansky. So we weren't able to converge our views, but we found some agreement over the required work in the future. It was seen that we need some better test statistics on the connection between the gamma ray flares and the VLTI core variability ejections and optical flares, EVTA changes. So this means larger samples, more work to be done. We also want to have as complete simultaneous multivariant coverage as possible, and we will need to have fill in the gaps in the SCD, far infrared and MEV. What do we want to correlate? This was also one of the discussion topics. Since the radion millimeter gamma ray characteristic timescales are different, does it make sense to correlate the peaks of the light curves? Another thing is that we need long-term light curves in order to get reasonable statistics and make any sensible inference. We have to use proper methods developed in the statistical time series analysis. And we are talking about flares, but also ask, are there flares at all, or are we just seeing random fluctuations? And one of the things also that was discussed is that we probably radio total flux density may not be the best thing to correlate with the gamma rays. So maybe we need to use some better timestamps, like the VLTI ejection epochs as has been done, or the polarization events. Okay, there were also interesting thoughts about theory simulations modeling. There are several models for quasar zone. In the most simple and traditional view, we have blobs which are filling the pool jet, and the fast gamma ray variability constrains the size of the blob. And if it's filling the pool jet with, it also places it very close to the apex of the jet. But if we have very, very short gamma ray emission, like the minute game scale emission variability in TV sources, this could require huge Lorentz factors, more than 50 in some of the TV sources, which seems to be in slight contradiction with the VLTI observations. So in order to get around this, other models have been proposed. One is localized energy dissipation where only a small portion of the jet is actually emitting. One of these is so-called jets and jet models. Crystal Nalak, like, was presenting a poster on these. And there we have perpendicular flows within the relativistic flow, where you can actually get quite a large emission Lorentz factors from moderate jet Lorentz factor and moderate emission region Lorentz factors, and this can be borrowed by magnetic reconnection. Another model presented there, two other models presented there, was an extension of the old Spada et al. Model presented by Jörg Rachen, where you have really dense series of blobs shot out from the central engine, and then they collide, and these collisions produce high energy emission. He was really interested in the synchrotron part of the emission, not the gamma ray emission in his talk. But he seems to be able to reproduce the spectral evolution of the PC4x4.3 layer from radio to millimeter wavelengths. Then there was a turbulent cell model presented by Alan Marshall, where the emission comes from the energized regions in the turbulent flow when they go through a standing shockwave. And the important point here is that the number of emitting cells depends highly on the frequency. So that shorter wavelengths, you have less emitting regions, which means shorter variability time scales and higher and more variable linear polarization. I think Marcus is going to discuss this further, so I'm going to skip that. One of the striking things to me was also the progress that has been done with the simulations. During the last couple of years, the three-dimensional general relativistic quantum hyperdynamic simulations have been able to produce high Lorentz factor jets that are stable up to 10 to 3 gravitational radii. And also, similar progress is being made in the relativistic particle in cell codes to explore the microphysics of these jets. Okay. The last thing I want to show you are some results from non-laser gamma ray AGN. And I found these very interesting in the meeting. So Fermi has found also gamma ray emission from other AGN than lasers. One new group is narrow line Seebeck ones. They seem to have their SED seem to be similar to lasers. They seem to have pretty high jet powers, and they show pretty high brightness temperature in VLDI. So in some sense, these are similar to lasers, but they are from spiral galaxies. They are from small mass black holes, I mean, below 10 to 8. And these sources have a really high activation rates, close to Eddington limit. Sorry, close to Eddington rate. So this is a new group of sources. Then there were also discussion of radio galaxies. Fermi has seen a number of radio galaxies, which means that we have now a larger range of viewing angles to study. Lasers are always pointing almost right at you, but with radio galaxies, we can study larger parameter space. NGC 1275 was seen, re-seen by Fermi, might have been already seen by Gosby in 1970s. It wasn't seen by Eckert, but it's now re-seen by Fermi. And here is the radio light curve. This may have something to do with the flare here or not. And not only the relativistic jets and the cores produce gamma rays, SEN-A, which is the closest radio log AGN to us, is so nearby that Fermi can actually resolve its large-scale structure, and it detects emission from the radio lobes. And this was a nice confirmation of the pre-mission expectations that Fermi will see gamma rays from the radio lobes. And finally, Will McConville here talked about 4C55.17, and whereas the previous sources show gamma rays because of the jet except for the lobes in the SEN-A, this one might not be actually a blazar, but it has properties of a young radio source. It has a symmetric extended morphology, very low maximum brightness temperature for a blazar, and no variability at all. And Fermi observes constant gamma ray flux from this source with pretty hard photon index. So maybe this is a detection of gamma rays from a young radio source, not from a blazar. And this is interesting, the hard gamma ray spectrum and the constancy of it is interesting because this might be something for the Cherenkov telescopes to observe and study EBL, since it's quite far away. Okay. Thank you. As my presentation was pretty incomplete and somewhat biased, I suggest that all of you go to this web address and download the full proceedings to see what amazing stuff there actually was in the meeting. Thank you. Well, I think we should ask the modelers, but the basic explanation is, of course, that in these models, it's considered that the radio that the emission region is optically thick for the radio, and it's thought that the radio comes from much further out, so it makes no sense to fit it. So that's the basic explanation.
Say something. It must be some frequency in which the proverbial maps. But maybe. Maybe not in others, but maybe in that way. Of course, it isn't a high frequency. Maybe
yes, well, there seems to be pretty good match, at least in some sources, between optical and gamma rays, but there is also maps in some sources for some events in millimeter and gamma rays, so this is complicated.
Oh, yes, in the sense that some sources may be emitted from closer in, some sources may be from closer out, but the gamma ray vision may not necessarily be stuck to the signal.
Exactly, radio. That's right.